Hello and welcome to another episode of the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. And today, there's no beating about the bush. There's so much folklore content packed into the interview in this episode that we can dispense with any preamble and just wade in. My guest today, Liza Frank, will certainly be known to anyone who follows any kind of folklore tweeting on the platform formerly known as Twitter. During lockdown, Liza started the Everyday Lore project, a year-long challenge looking at ways in which she could incorporate folklore, superstition, and tradition into her life each day. This led to the publication of her book, Everyday Folklore with Murdoch, in October of last year. Liza continues to look at many ways in which all of us can interact with folklore, and she even has a new, self-managed role as the Folklore Agony Aunt, suggesting fun ways that you can use folklore to solve your everyday problems. I don't need to tell you any more. Here are Liza and myself covering all of this, and so much more, in a recent interview. Liza Frank, welcome to the Folklore Podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
It's my very, very great pleasure to finally have you on this podcast. It was in the mid-19th century that William John Toms first coined the use of the word folklore.
Yes.
So well over 100 years now we've been using that term. And that kind of feels like how long it's taken us to both be in the same room to talk about it somehow.
Yes. We've been planning this for a while, but various things have just kept getting in the way.
They have. Health and business and, yes, all sorts. But here we are. Here we are. No interruptions, hopefully. This is when a courier comes to your door or something else happens. But let's go for it. Let's go for it and see where it takes us. I'd like to start with you, because you are the most important person in this interview, and people may not know too much about you and your background and how you became interested in folklore and all the other glorious and wonderful things that you've done, how many celebrity boyfriends you may or may not have. You're going to have to talk about that now I've mentioned it.
Yes.
So tell us all about Liza.
Well, I've done a little bit of everything, I think. Not that I know exactly what everything means, but so I started off as a stage manager in theatre, and I stage managed all up and down the country and around the world, and had a glorious time working with all sorts of amazing people in amazing venues, doing the most weird and wonderful things. And everything was very magical, because theatre is essentially very magical. What you see in the audience is absolutely nothing to do with what's going on backstage and how you make things happen. So I was Tinkerbell once for Peter Pan at the West Yorkshire Playhouse. I was the ASM, but I also had an enormous fishing rod that was like 30 foot long with a tiny, tiny light at the end of it and a flick switch by the handle. And I would sort of like waft this Tinkerbell across for the curtain call. So everyone went, "Oh, look, the fairy." And it's actually sort of like me in a balaclava with a fishing rod.
Have you ever been the woman in black?
Not in the play, but I have worn full blacks with balaclava and gone onto stage to do various scene changes.
That kind of counts, because the woman in The Woman in Black is generally, I believe, the wardrobe mistress.
Probably, yes.
Yeah. Just wondered.
I have, in various scene changes, I've been a boy, which was a huge challenge for the wardrobe mistress to make me into a boy, because I was like a 27-year-old woman. I've also done it in full Elizabethan costume. You name it, I've probably worn it to do a scene change. It was fantastic. It was a really bonkers time in my life. And then I sort of stopped and went back to school. And the magic was just missing, because you have, even though it's a repetitive thing and you do it again and again and it's based on tradition and things like that, there is something, you know, out of normal world, I would say, which is a bit of a weird way of saying it, I think. So I sort of segued into photography. So this is where the My Celebrity Boyfriend comes in. I was studying photography, and I was very late on a project, and so I decided to take a friend of mine into town, and she took photos of me propositioning men on the street, asking them to pretend to be my boyfriend. It was a street photography project, and that sort of morphed into My Celebrity Boyfriend because I knew so many famous guys. And that was my graduation project, and I created an entire sitting room of full of picture frames with me and Martin Clunes and John Hannah and Johnny Vegas and people like that, and caused a little bit of consternation at my college. And then because connections are weird, I was working for one of the wives of one of my celebrity boyfriends as a children's shoe fitter. And Sharon, who this woman that I was working with, amazing woman, her best friend's sister was the commissioning editor at Bloomsbury, and they all got drunk one night, and I got a phone call the next day saying, can you come in? I have some photographs. So I sort of went in with a little box of, you know, goodies and came out with a publishing deal. It was very, very surreal. So that was My Celebrity Boyfriend. It was published a long time ago, about 14 years ago in 2007, and is just a coffee table book full of me posing with famous men pretending to be my boyfriend. And they got to choose everything, so they were completely comfortable. You know, I wasn't sort of like trying to touch them or sniff them, although some of them were very, very pretty.
That would be a whole different book, I think.
That would be a whole different book. So they had complete creative control, and I would just turn up with the camera and go, so how do you want me? And that was great fun. And then I sort of like didn't know what to do, and sort of meandered around a bit, and then ended up doing a master's in creative and life writing. And it was sort of then that I kind of made the connection between folklore and the way that my brain thinks, because all the stories I was writing, and I'd just done a degree as well, and I'd done a lot of creative writing for the degree, seemed to incorporate elements of folklore, so mermaids, or repurposing Greek myths, or, you know, just or you know, taking a character from one situation from a famous story and then, you know, putting it into something that you wouldn't expect. And so I started kind of interrogating myself about, you know, what does this mean? Am I sort of plagiarizing? What am I doing? How is my, you know, what am I doing creatively with folklore? And, you know, and then I suddenly thought, well, actually, everything I read as a child, you know, was Alan Garner, Ursula Le Guin, Lloyd Alexander, Joan Aitken. It was just all completely folklore. And I was thinking, oh my goodness. Okay, so I just have to pay attention to this a little bit more. And so I was in my friend's kitchen, as you do, eating roasted chickpeas, I believe, because she keeps reminding me. And we both read a book called The Stones Are Hatching, which is an amazing book by an author called Geraldine McSomething, whose name I can't pronounce, and I don't want to completely embarrass myself by trying. And the character just basically lived by the rules of folklore. And we were talking about this, like, is it possible? And we kind of decided that it would be fun to try. And then just, you know, 10 years went by and we didn't do it. And then I decided that actually I did want to do it. I wanted to see if it was possible, you know, never cut my hair on a Friday, cut all my fingernails into three so that the devil couldn't make a ship of them. You know, only use green coloured envelopes, you know, it's all that sort of stuff. So I decided that 2020 was going to be the year that I was going to do it. And I had a big spreadsheet. It was like a big Tetris thing. So, you know, I wasn't doing love divinations twice in a row or whatever. And it was all based on the calendar days or the months or the seasons. And I had a big wall chart and everything was fabulous. And I started and it was great. And so every day that I would experience some sort of folklore and I would write about it and publish it on my blog. And it was going great. And then on the 25th of January, which is Burns Night, amongst other things, there are lots of different folklore happening on the 25th of January, it was foggy. And it said that if it's foggy on this particular day, something wicked this way comes. And, you know, we locked down about 2 months later. So it's it changed everything. And I had to make a decision of whether or not I continued, because I'd in my head, I was going to be swanning around the UK, going to Herring Queen festivals and cuckoo fairs and jumping over bonfires. And I ended up recreating everything in my sitting room, you know, sort of making a wicker man out of a toilet roll and googly eyes and setting light to it in a baking tray in the garden. You know, it's that sort of thing. But I decided that, you know, to go on, you know, I'd done a couple of months and it would be such a shame. And I'm really pleased that I did, because it was just the most bonkers year.
Well, I think everybody's really pleased that you did, because it ultimately lent lots of material to your furtive mind and imagination in which to create your book,
yes,
which is an almanac of all of these wonderful things. And, you know, you've proven that you don't need to swan around the country to engage with folklore. You can swan around your house and swan,
yes,
around the internet and swan around your own personal library and,
yes,
engage with it in equally as effective a way.
Yes.
Which is precisely what you've done. We'll come back a little later on to this this theme of engaging with folklore in your everyday life. Mm. Let's talk a little bit first about the way that you've constructed your book, Everyday Lore, and the themes that are in it. So there's a very, very handy folklore key in the front of this
yes,
book, which breaks everything down into lots of different topic areas. A few examples: animal lore, apotropaic, magic, calendar customs, celebrations, food, love, luck, remedies, plant lore, weather lore. All the kind of key topics of folklore are in there, aren't they? How did you decide how you were going to distill centuries of folklore into these key topics?
Very good question. It's it was really difficult. One of the easiest ways of doing it is because I only had sort of a maximum of 200 words per entry, less if I could. So, you know, things like Burns Night, where you've got haggis, you've got Robert Burns. It's also the Welsh Saints Day, St. Dernwyn or St. Drinwyn. I can never remember her name. She's the Welsh St. Valentine's. So you've got all the folklore to do with her. So I had to make choices. And the choices that I made was that I didn't want any misogyny, any xenophobia, any racism, any hatred towards anybody else. It's virtually bloodless. There are a couple of questionable practices in there, usually to do with corpses. So when I sort of stripped everything away that I didn't want, because I think folklore should be accessible to everybody, and if you're continually coming up about, you know, and the woman was amazing, but then she got beheaded, you know, it can be a little bit off-putting.
It puts a bit of a downer on the subject, doesn't it? Yeah.
A tiny bit, yes. So there were certain editing choices that made it easier. And then, of course, it was looking at the date. So, you know, what does the date present? Oh, I think love divination would be perfect for this day, because on this day you collect crab apples and you put them in an attic and you form them into the shape of the initials of your lover. You know, it's that sort of thing. So that it was a little bit of a process, and I genuinely chose the stuff that I really liked, as opposed to choosing the stuff that I had to because it was connected to the day.
So you broke it down into, say, all of these key topics.
Yes.
Give us a couple of examples of topic areas which particularly appealed to you, whether that was through the way that you had to engage with them or the material itself.
I absolutely loved the remedies. The remedies I found absolutely fascinating. It's so, you know, how do you decide, who decided at some point that wrapping a ribbon around your forehead that had been blessed by St. Bridget was going to cure migraines? Who is it that sort of trialed that or tested it? You know, the drugs these days go through immense trials and everything, but sort of folklore goes, yeah, it's fine. If you, you know, if you grate some raw garlic and put some black pepper into a shot of vodka and take it, it's going to completely cure your cold.
Yeah, I've often wondered whether it kind of went a couple of people going, oh, Nigel's looking a bit peaky. That plant over there might be good. Let's try it. Well, he hasn't died. Is he any better? And it's a process of narrowing it down.
Yes. It's like, so who, and but my favorite one is, who decided that weasels sucking out sores and ulcers was the ultimate remedy for them? You know, it's like, did somebody trap a weasel and just try and latch it onto their leg or something?
It's you've got to wonder.
You've got to wonder. And I find a lot of them absolutely charming. I mean, I lent quite heavily on Culpepper because his sort of remedy book was amazing. His plant law book was amazing. And Roy Vickery as well. He did fantastic A to Z of flora. And so you can just find the most delightful things in it. And then you find the most horrific things. Like, so dandelions, I rather like a nice dandelion. I had no idea that the local name for dandelion was piss the bed or piss a bed. And that's throughout the country. And it is basically, it's a diuretic. If you eat too many of them, there you go. So, I think probably plant law remedies I found absolutely fascinating. And it's something that I still kind of dabble in and look at.
And of course, when you look at modern remedies, whether they be herbal remedies or other things, there's so much that carries across from the folklore and I suppose we could use old wives' tales as a generic term for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
You go round Holland and Barrett or somewhere like that, you know, other herbal remedy shops are available. Then you look at the ingredients in a lot of these things and you see stuff that comes from these older folk remedies. Snail gel for ear infections is one that I always draw on, because snails for deafness, there are thousands of different folkloric remedies involving snails for deafness and ear problems. So there's a lot of good science rooted in these old folk remedies, aren't there?
Yeah. It's almost as if people sort of ran out of what scientific thing we can do. So let's go and raid the archives of what people used to do and see if they worked. And I think quite a few of them are quite legitimate. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm getting over having a cold at the moment. One of the reasons that we rescheduled over the last couple of days. So go on, cure me.
Well, actually, one of my favourite, I don't know if you have a sore throat, but one of my absolute favourite remedies is taking fresh thyme and just putting boiling water on it and treating it like a tea. It's quite weird because it's almost like you're drinking stock or drinking gravy. It's got that sort of Sunday lunch slash medicinal feeling to it. But that's definitely something that has always calmed my throat. Whether or not it's a placebo, I don't know, but I don't think there's anything wrong with having a hot drink if it's going to sort of just loosen everything up.
I think you can argue that if a placebo is effective and it doesn't do any harm, then it might as well be a remedy anyway.
Exactly. Something that you might want to try. I have no idea if you've got any horseradish in the house. Horseradish, wasabi, anything like that?
I can't stand wasabi, I have to admit. horseradish, possibly in the back of a cupboard, you never know.
Well, so one thing that you can do is you can chew horseradish. That's an old remedy, and that will literally blast everything. That's going to be pain. So another one you can do is if you've been boiling potatoes for your tea, keep the water keep the water hot, and then do, you know, like my mum used to do. She used to shove me over a bowl of boiling water with a lump of Vicks in it and put a towel over my head. But you can do that with potato water. You can do grate radish into that, and you can do that with radish water as well. Horseradish water.
Presumably because of the starch in terms of potato water?
No idea. I didn't actually go into that. I just thought it's another thing for potatoes, because the old, you know, the old folklore thing is if a potato doesn't work, then you're doing something wrong. You know, rub a potato on a wart, rub a potato on a windscreen, it'll stop the ice. You know, that is the starch.
Yeah, I literally yesterday saw a social media post about using potatoes on Tinder, which I thought was great.
Hang on, Tinder the dating app or Tinder?
Yes. Tinder the dating app.
What?
You need more information here, don't you?
I do. I need some context.
So there are so many bots on Tinder,
yeah,
or similar things trying to entice you into what looks like a relationship but will ultimately be some kind of scam, that somebody has developed a routine that they've posted screenshots of now, where they just ask anybody who messages them on Tinder to say the word potato. And there's this just whole thing about, you know, thanks for liking me. You know, if you want to come and see my profile, blah, 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 say potato, Elizabeth. And then the next thing happens, it's like, no, say potato. And if they don't say potato, they're a bot. So you could even use them for dating. There you go.
Oh, you see, potatoes are just the best thing ever.
And multi-purpose.
Multi-purpose. Yes. And you get chips.
Just... even better.
Exactly.
So if you don't get a date, at least you get chips.
Exactly. And sometimes chips is better.
yeah, often. Let's pick a couple more topic areas from your key to the world's folklore. Celebrations and festivals, and we'll broaden it out, calendar customs, calendar events, all of those sorts of things. The things that you were going to travel around the country doing, that ultimately you did from the comfort of your own bed / sofa / wherever you were reclining when you did the research for some of this. Do you now have a list of things that you would like to go and visit based on your research? Give us a couple of examples of ones that you like.
I really want to go and watch. I don't want to participate in it, but I really, really want to watch the gravy wrestling.
Oh, yes.
That's at Stacksteads, I think. I want to say Stacksteads in Lancashire. And it's, there's just a lot of gravy, vegan, I think it is now. And a lot of people dressed in fancy dress wrestling in it. And that to me is like the ultimate day out. That just sounds so much fun.
I have to admit, that one caused me a bit of an issue because I clipped a newspaper cutting about the gravy wrestling for the library and archive recently, and I've still got it on one side because I can't decide which category to put it in.
Yeah, that was, I think I put that one under competition.
Yeah, that's plausible. I think somebody else had suggested that it went under unusual sports.
Oh, you see, the unusual sports are my favourite, because you've got, as well as gravy wrestling, there's toe wrestling, where everybody, you know, you have to barefooted and you have to wrangle your toes together. And again, that just looks bonkers. I would probably try that one.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
Exactly. And then there's the shin kicking competition at the Cotswold Olympics. You're not allowed to have steel toe caps, so I probably would try that one. I think you're allowed to have sort of like straw next to the skin, so you sort of like make a straw barrier. but you can't. So I think that one would be quite fun. The Knaresborough bed race, I would love to take part in that on the bed, not pushing the bed, where you have to push a bed through the town and through the river in order to win. I think that one would be fantastic. I'm just thinking what else I'd quite like. There are so many. Every county has their own interpretation of their own calendar customs. So, for instance, there used to be quite a lot of cuckoo fairs around Sussex. But there are other there are I'm just trying to think now. My mind obviously has gone blank. So there are lots of saints' days, not just to do with England, Wales, and Scotland. You've got St. Piran down in Cornwall. So there's all sorts of celebrations that you can do for that, particularly dressing up as a badger. I quite like the idea of
Important.
dressing up a badger and then doing the Trelawney shout in the evening, which is a toast with alcohol, which again, I'd quite like to partake of. And
I think one of our most impressive ones in Devon is probably the Ottery St. Mary tar barrels. Have you
yes,
been?
I haven't been. I'd like to go. Yes.
You must come down. I will take you to the Ottery St. Mary tar barrels. If we both survive, we can report back on it afterwards. I have been. It's an amazing experience, but it
Oh,
is deadly.
what was your favorite bit about it? What did you
Getting out, I think, probably.
like?
No, I mean, seriously, I think it is just the atmosphere of being in an immensely crowded space in the
Yes.
center of the town, and knowing and seeing coming towards you, the approach of what are, for the men's, particularly because there are the women's, the children's, and the men's barrels. For the men's barrels especially, although also some of the ladies, to be fair, immensely sized barrels. Which for those that don't know, the people who run the Ottery St. Mary tar barrels, the barrel has tar on the inside, it has no top or bottom to it. They set light to the inside of the barrel. And they run through the streets carrying them on their shoulders, literally until they fall apart in the street. And if you're in the way, you're in the way and you will get run over. There is no two ways about it. There's no marshalling. There's nothing like that. It is like a massive, enormous flaming barrel is coming towards you at the speed that a town rugby player can run. You move or you get hit, and that's it. But there's something about the whole atmosphere of the experience of that. It's hot, it's scary, it's primal, but it's just brilliant. And I would recommend it very, very highly.
Absolutely. And it's something out of the ordinary because we all sort of live our lives without magic most of the time because we're having to go to the office or cleaning up cat sick or looking after children. And but you go to somewhere where it's just ridiculous. There's fire, there's lots of running, and it just takes you a little bit out of your own life, and it just gives you something else to think about. I love
And there's
that.
chips. So come down, I'll take you, we'll try and not get run over, and then you can have chips.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. Potato and tar barrels. Perfect.
What else? Anything else that takes your fancy that you'd quite like to visit from what you found?
Scotland has amazing festivals all the way through the year. So you've got Upheliar, which is at the end of January, which is a big fire festival with Vikings and the big ceilidhs throughout the night, and you need a lot of stamina for that. But I think they have, that I think that's on Shetland. So I'd like to
Yes.
go to something like that. There's a Turning of the Stone, which I think is in Dorset on Halloween, where there's this big boulder, and if the stone doesn't get turned, the devil is released.
That's in
And
Shebbear in North Devon.
that's right. And on the 2 years that they weren't able to turn the stone, because I think it was probably war years where the women couldn't turn the stone. the crops failed. So it is something that is religiously done every year.
Yeah, in fact, they turned it during lockdown by arrangement. And socially distanced, if I remember rightly. I think they made a successful case to turn it during lockdown.
That's
no audience. Nobody was able to go and witness it. But I think it did happen.
I'm pleased because there is something amazing about continuity and doing something again and again and again, just because it's almost in your DNA.
And that's the thing about superstition as well, isn't it? Is that, yes, it wasn't turned during the war years and the crops failed. There are perfectly logical reasons during the war years why the crops would have failed that are not related necessarily to the superstition of turning the stone, obviously. But at the same time, it's a great and significant and meaningful coincidence, if coincidence is what it is. Let's keep an open mind. And with a lot of these superstitions, you know, every time you go out of the house, you may well salute a magpie if there's just one. I know I do. Do I believe that it's bad luck? Who knows? Do you want to tempt fate? That's the key thing, isn't it? Superstition is ingrained like that.
Yes, although I do often walk underneath ladders. I regularly put up umbrellas in my house, mainly because I forget.
And also walking around a ladder, you're likely to get hit by a pot of paint that falls off the top of it if they're decorating, so it's probably safer underneath anyway.
Exactly. And the way that the ladders are positioned around here, you have to go into the road, so I'm more likely to get knocked over by a cyclist. So also when you do something for so many years and it becomes part of life within a community, it does have the power to bring everybody together, even if it's just for 10 minutes. Everybody kind of puts everything aside and then you just do this thing and then it goes back to normal. But there is just something really special about a moment in time where people just don't question, they just do.
Yeah, I mean, that is an important point of all celebratory or calendrical folklore, isn't it? It is a community event and it has all of that behind it.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of calendar customs where it's more singular. So there was when I was doing the project, there was a lot of times when not just because of the lockdown where I wasn't able to share very widely what I was doing, things like weather lore. So, you know, when there are various days where if it rains, you're in huge trouble. But if it's sunny, you're also in huge trouble. It gets very, depends who you ask, basically. Mm. And, you know, little things like if you follow weather law, it sort of shapes how you decide how you're going to go about your day. So if you see a ring around the moon, does that mean that you're then going to change your plans for the next day because it's possibility of rain? Or if you see macro scales, are you going to change? So it can be quite singular in the way that you approach your life if you subscribe to that particular belief.
And folklore is often, particularly with things like weather lore or food lore, often is very contradictory.
Yes.
And that's a problem if you're trying to engage with it in the way that you did, surely, as well, isn't it? It's like, I can make this, but I shouldn't make it on a Good Friday because that's bad. Although if I make it on a Good Friday, it's also good because... And there's all sorts of contradictions to try and work your way around.
There is. And I think you just have to... I basically took the path of what suited me, which is incredibly selfish. So I took into account what Yorkshire was saying about it, or what Devon was saying about it, or East Anglia was saying about it. And then I thought, well, what would Sussex do? And, you know, what makes the most sense for me? Because a lot of them don't make any sense at all, because, you know, why would on this particular day only be sunny 1 year out of seven? You know, it's some of it's very strange. So I basically did what was right for me. And not going to lie, crossed my fingers that was the right choice. But you know, if everyone has an opinion on something, you kind of got to go with what feels good for you.
I think there's a hashtag to be had in there somewhere, isn't there? WWSD, what would Sussex do?
Sussex always does good.
I think we should campaign for that to be a hashtag wherever we're unsure about anything in folklore.
Yeah.
What would Sussex do?
What would Sussex do?
You mentioned going back to the gravy wrestling, the fact... I mean, I'm going somewhere with this, honestly. You mentioned the fact that it's now, as far as you can recall, vegan gravy. Mm-hmm. And that actually raised an interesting and important point in my mind, because that's obviously a change from the original tradition based on modern values. And I wonder how many other things you might have found, or maybe you don't agree that that's what it is.
Actually, the reason that they had to change it is because the original recipe attracted wasps.
Ah, interesting.
So they did have to do that. But I am, you actually raise a really interesting point, because there are often people that argue, we can't change this tradition. This tradition has been like this since the dawn of time. We need to keep doing it in a certain way. And that certain way might contradict the values that we have, or a lot of values that we have, or that we have today. So there is an argument to be had that actually what you feel may be dawn of time, or 200 years old, or even 50 years old, will have changed. So whenever anybody says to me, we have to do this, you know, this is the way that it's done, we can't change it, and I'd sort of like go, so the way that you get to this particular event, do you walk or do you take a car? How do you arrange this event? Do you arrange this event on the telephone, or do you go to each person's house and discuss it with them? The clothes that you wear, are they the original clothes, or have they been made with modern textiles using modern making techniques? And when you actually break it down, everything has changed. You know, we have motorways now. So stuff that was rural, that William Toms was collecting back in the 19th century, there was no motorways, there were no mobile phones. It was, so something that might have been collected as a custom then will have by, you know, just by time will have changed. So I think there is no argument of we cannot change this because this is the way it has always been done, because I can pick that argument apart in seconds.
It's also the case that it's very difficult often, despite the best efforts of some people, to prove continuity in a lot of customs and beliefs and practices and followings and all sorts of things. And there's a lot of folklore, living folklore now, folklore custom celebrations, festivals, all of those things we've just been talking about, that have come out of folk revival. So we don't know exactly how it looked originally.
No.
But we've recreated it the best way we can. I'm in charge of the music for the Hunting of the Earl of Roane, which is one of the hobby horse festivals down in the southwest, for example. Now, that was banned in 1837, and it was revived in the 70s based on what scant written records and things there were. But a lot of that has to obviously be best guess. And you base that on other existing traditions that have more longevity, and you base it on written records, and you base it on imagination and all sorts of different things. Alongside revival, there's also this kind of resurgence as well, resurgence of interest in folklore.
Yes.
And I think we're in the third period of that, probably. So we have the resurgence of interest in folklore in the Victorian and Edwardian periods, when all the white upper class, middle class men were collecting folklore and interpreting it badly.
Yes.
We then have the second resurgence of interest post-war, when everybody kind of focuses on that community aspect again after the trials of war and so on. And now we have, in the 21st century, a third, I think, resurgence of interest. And it's more difficult now, I think, to pinpoint exactly why that is the case. Any ideas?
I haven't really thought about it. I mean, there is always usually a little bit of a folklore boost when things like The Witcher comes out on Netflix or The Lord of the Rings comes out, the films for Lord of the Rings. There's always seems to be a correlation when there's a book or a film or a television series that come out and people start getting into Dungeons and Dragons again. And I'll be honest, I don't really know. I think it's also an escapism. You know, it's the potentially, you know, we're very reliant on modern technology and computers and phones. And if you then go for a respite in Sherwood Forest dressed as Maid Marian for a weekend because there's a lovely event going on celebrating Robin Hood, then it's taking you out of your day-to-day and putting you in a situation where anything is possible. And I think that possibly may be one of the reasons. I don't know.
I think there's a couple of things that you've probably highlighted there that feed into this. Modern technology, I think, is definitely one. I think in her TED talk on folklore, Lynn McNeil described the internet as the world's largest folklore archive. It's just yes. That it's, you know, it's uncatalogued. And that raises an important point because people have access to so much more material on this subject that they wouldn't have had easy access to before, and very fast access. And what you find often with folklore is that you see something that a particular culture is doing, and you're not aware of that ceremony or ritual or whatever it is, but you're aware that it kind of seems similar somehow to things that you know from your own culture.
Yeah.
And I think we have easier access to other cultures' folklore now, and it resonates with us. And I think that that kind of global community aspect is bigger now. I suspect that's something to do with it.
That sounds incredibly plausible. And of course, folklore not being just sort of mermaids and Morris dancing, you could probably write an entire dissertation on that.
I think another aspect is perhaps that there's a lot of tension in the world now. I mean, there's always global tension, and there's always things that are difficult to deal with in the world. But again, the global community means that we're kind of experiencing everybody's tensions almost firsthand, but not quite.
Yes.
And maybe this sense of, you know, safe and nostalgic and cozy folklore is something that we fall back on to offset that as well.
The Merry England.
Exactly.
Things are always so much better back in the past where we didn't have to deal with X, Y, and Z. And it's, you just kind of think, well, who is it better for? Because there are very few people that it was actually better for back then. And just because the rural peasants had a jolly good time at harvest home doesn't mean that they didn't have a really shockingly or difficult life the rest of the year. I think it's quite a tricky one, but I'm glad that it's happening because I think everybody should get a little bit of magic and mystery and ridiculously bonkers things in their life.
Yes, absolutely. And let's move on to talk about how people can do that. One of the key things about folklore, of course, is that it tells us who we are. It explains our place in the world, in the landscape, in society. It explains our identity. It allows us to understand who we are in relation to other people and which folk groups we sit within and so on. So our lives are intrinsically linked to folklore. We come across it multiple times every day. We don't necessarily realize that we're interacting with it or how we're doing it or the fact that it's there, but we are.
Yes.
But you want people to look to engage with folklore more practically and understand what they're doing. Now, this is not something obviously that's unique to you. There are lots of people who do this as part of the pathways and the practices that they follow anyway.
Yes.
My film and non-print media correspondent on the podcast, Tracy, who's based over in Chicago, has her own podcast called Folkloring, which is exactly this. That's a term that her and her co-host kind of concocted to explain this practice of interacting with folklore as part of your everyday life, whether it's baking bread, whether it's setting up an altar in your house, or whatever. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about, isn't it? How do you want people to look to do this sort of thing?
I think that we're all sort of, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the global tensions and everything else like that. I just think this is what I found out when I was doing the project, is taking 5-10 minutes, or sometimes, you know, 4 hours if I was doing something huge, out of my day to do something that you wouldn't normally do, just kind of resets you slightly. For me, it was almost like a bit of a meditation, you know, although whenever I do meditation, I end up doing automatic writing because I fidget too much. But it's just, I suppose, bringing something a little wonky into your life, something that is a little bit surprising that you can't quite put your finger on why you do it, like the saluting magpies. So one of the easiest things I would say is doing a little bit of divination. So we've talked in the past about cheese divination.
Yes, we have.
Yes. And I'm slightly obsessed with cheese divination.
Yes, you are.
Yes, I am. So, you know, if you've got a decision to make, say you, you're in an amazing position where you have got five offers to five universities and you just can't decide which university you're going to go to, get five lumps of cheese, write the initial of each university on one lump of cheese, leave it out of the fridge, and the first one that goes moldy, that's your choice made. It's a bit like flipping a coin, just with cheese.
It is, however, a waste of cheese.
They don't have to be big cubes.
Little tiny pieces of cheese.
Little tiny pieces. You know, or if you're lucky enough to have mice, you can carve your the initials of whatever it is that you want. A question, maybe you've got three lovers you have proposed to you, and you need to know who you should marry. You know, you pop your cheese cubes in a cage full of mice, and marked with the initial of each lover, and it's whatever gets eaten first, that's, you know, that's the husband for you to be, you know. So, and also the shape of the holes. So this one is apparently a bit like tassiomancy, which is tea leaf reading. So, you know, if you have a heart-shaped hole, you're going to have love in your life. If you've got a coffin-shaped hole, you know, start making a will. You know, it's all the patterns in the mold. So something just delightful like that. There's also bananas. You can do divination by bananas. I'm particularly fond of food divination because it's something that hopefully everybody has in their house.
Okay, you may want to go into a little more detail on banana divination.
So bananas, you can only ask yes or no questions to. They don't respond to anything other than yes or no. They don't even do maybe, it's just yes or no. So the opposite end to the stalk has that little black bit in it. So what you do, you have a question: do I take the job with the Royal Shakespeare Company, or do I take the job with the Almeida? So what you do is you cut the end off, just a tiny sliver, like a couple of millimeters from the end of the banana. And when you look at the end, you will either see a blob, a black blob, or you will see a blob in the shape of a Y. If you get the Y, it's yes. If you get the blob, it's no. So, you know, it's just tiny little silly things that you can do just to give yourself an internal chuckle. So you're putting your banana on your cereal in the morning. Just ask it a question: am I going to have a good day today, or do I need to salute a lot of magpies on my way to work?
People listening to this episode, tweet myself and Liza with photos of your banana slivers when you try this. tell us what the question was that you asked, or email us thefolklorepodcast@gmail.com. Send in your banana divinations, successful or otherwise. We want to see what you did.
Exactly. And I want to know if they came true, because relentless. The year that I did was relentless, and there were a couple of times where I did some divinations and then I just didn't follow up on them because I'd gone on to the next thing. But one thing that I really loved, it was one of my favorite ones, is that there is a belief that there is an hour every day where wishes come true. And so I did this for one of the days, and so I carved it up into sort of like 7 to 8, 8 to 9, blah, blah, blah. And each hour I wished for something different, so that I could, you know, if any of them came true, I could go, ah, yesterday it was the hour between 10 and 11. And I had a big grid. And then I realized I couldn't, you have to be really specific with wishes, because you can't sort of like be wishy-washy about them, because otherwise they can be reinterpreted by the people that interpret the wishes in order to grant them. So you had to be really, really specific. And I wasn't expecting any of these to work. But I got to sort of like the afternoon and realized that one of the wishes had come true, and it was a really specific one, something that should never have come true because it hadn't happened in the last sort of like 7 years. And I just went, oh, okay, that's really, really interesting. And that worked. And now I know which hour of the day on this particular day is the day, you know, is the hour when the wishes come true. So if you are going to do divination, and if you are going to try several times to do divination, do make a record, because then you can reflect back and go, oh, I see, that's what happened.
Liza, I think we're going to have to get you back on at some point for a Folklore Podcast lecture Zoom, so that we can do an in-camera thing, and we'll do some experimenting over different types of folklore interaction with an audience and see what we can come up with.
I would love that. I did one recently with apple pips. So on Halloween, you put 3 apple pips on your forehead, and the first one, or the last one to fall off, is going to be your destiny. So there are lots we can do.
Yeah, let's chat offline, and we'll come up with a plan for an audience-based thing that everybody can participate in. I think that would be brilliant.
That'd be amazing.
Are you still doing things each day?
No, but I am still, there are still several things that I do. So during the lockdown, my friend Sarah, who's an amazing folklorist, she and I did Stir Up Sunday, which is on the Sunday, the last Sunday before Advent in November, and it's to make your Christmas pudding. And there are various, you know, you're supposed to have 13 ingredients, and you're supposed to put in rings and keys and all sorts of things into the, which we didn't do any of it. We did stir it sunwise, but we were over Zoom, and it was very, very entertaining. And we've done it every year since. And sometimes we can't do Stir Up Sunday. So I think this year, or rather last year, just gone, I think we did Stir Up Tuesday. And it is just genuinely one of my favorite times of the year, because it's just, we talk nonsense, making a boiled, you know, pudding. And it's just glorious.
Do you both have hundreds of people to feed in your house that you're making a gigantic pudding, or...?
I usually end up making 2, so yes, there are lots of people that are eating it.
Are they all you in different jumpers?
Some of them are, of them are, but there are other males that are very, very appreciative of the vast amounts of chocolate that I tend to put in the pudding.
Perfect. Okay, we probably need to draw this to a conclusion in a moment, as we're approaching the hour mark, I think, looking at my other screen. If you had one takeaway from this whole project, everything that you've done that led to the publication of Everyday Lore, and all of the things that you tried during lockdown, and what you experienced and what you came to understand from it all, what would your one takeaway from this whole project be, do you think?
Don't be scared. I think I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I sometimes don't do something because I think it's going to be, I'm going to look ridiculous doing it, or I might fail at it, or, you know, there are 1,001 reasons why I shouldn't be doing it, because I should be writing something sensible or cleaning the house or looking after somebody. And I think just do it, just try. And just have fun. It, you know, the world doesn't stop because a plum duff ruins your tea towel. And I just think if there is something out there that captures your fancy, like being the back end of a pantomime horse in a pantomime horse race, just do it. It's don't let anything stop you. Just do it, I think.
It's good advice. Okay, so to give it its correct and full title, because I'm aware that I've been abbreviating it all through the interview just because it was easier. Everyday Folklore, an Almanac for the Ritual Year. The full title of your book is available from all good bookshops and probably some dodgy ones as well. In a glorious gold and green hardback with lovely sprayed edges, and it is a delightful book, isn't it? Where are you going next? Are you going to publish anything else similar or different? What else are you working on? You should probably talk a little bit at this point about your work, and I use the word work in inverted commas, as an agony aunt, and get people to send you their folklore problems. We can address this at this point too. What else is happening in your life?
So yes, I do an irregular column. I would like it to be regular, but I'm fitting it in with other things. I write as the folklore agony aunt. So if you have, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a folklore related problem. If you have any kind of problem that the normal conventional wisdom hasn't sort of cleared up for you, and you're still sort of really in a tears about what to do, if you send it to me, I will give you the folklorist's appraisal of what you could do. So that could be anything from having a duck quack in your mouth 3 times, or how to reverse a curse, how to make yourself more confident going to a job interview, how to get over a broken heart, you know, anything. Folklore will have an answer for that. And I will I'll do a deep dive into the weird and wonderful world of remedies and advice and things you put in your ears and under your pillow and under your bed. And I will come up with a solution that you might not have thought of to try.
If a duck quacks in your mouth, does it echo?
Well, do you know what? If I find a duck and I can entice it to quacking, I will tell you that answer, because now I want to know.
Well, there is a whole kind of folkloric discussion around whether or not it's apocryphal that a duck's quack doesn't echo, isn't there? So I think it would be a good way to pull it all together.
I'm game. Find me a duck. I'm there.
Perfect. Excellent. I have friends who keep ducks.
Oh, okay. So when we do the tar barrels,
yeah, we'll do the ducks. Yeah,
and we'll do some cheese, and I'll bring a banana as well. It'll be perfect. Fabulous. Yes.
Perfect. What else are you working on?
That I'm desperate to do some fiction. I've been doing writing nonfiction for a while now. I've just finished a master's in folklore studies, and that was a big old dissertation and on Fear of the Dark and folklore. So I really want to write some fiction. So I'm looking a little bit at poetry. I'm looking a little bit at death, just because the folklore surrounding death is absolutely fascinating, especially in Victorian times. So I'm trying to work out a little bit more of a fiction side, but also, fiction.
Fiction would be great. Would be great. Just keep it broad. Fiction. Let's go from there. We'll see where it takes us. That would be
fiction, poetry, all of that stuff, but with a folklore lens.
Yes, absolutely. And finally, if people want to find out more about all of the things you've been talking about on the interweb, where should they go and find you?
At my website, which is www.liza-frank.com. And that's Liza with a Z. So just think there's a hole in my bucket, dear Liza, dear Liza, or Liza Minnelli. Either will do, but there's no S anywhere in my name. You can also find me on Twitter at Lily the Punk, which is Lili the Punk. And I think I'm on other platforms as Lily the Punk as well.
Probably.
Probably. Yeah.
But you are pretty active on Twitter /X / that platform. So
yes.
so that's a good place to go for sure. Liza, we've known each other for quite a long time. We've interacted online for quite a long time.
Yes.
We've never actually met in person. And I think
no.
This is probably the first time that we've actually met in a Zoom room as well,
yeah.
To be honest. I think most of our stuff has been on Twitter previously.
Yes.
And a whole load of emails rescheduling this interview for the last 12 months, obviously. This has been so much fun. It's been an absolute pleasure to finally have you on here. We will definitely do some more things, and
brilliant.
we'll plot an experimental folklore podcast lecture at some point that everybody can interact with. That would be great.
That would be amazing. And thank you so much for having me on. It's been an absolute delight. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. And I shall look forward to whatever we do next.
Tar barrels and chips.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Liza's book is available from all the sorts of places that books can usually be found. And you can learn more about her and contact her with the problems that you would like solving folklorically via her website. Links, as usual, on the Folklore Podcast website on the page for this episode. Look out for more content coming on the Folklore Podcast feed very soon, as the recordings that I made at the UK Ghost Story Festival in Derby get released. And also, following a recent audience poll that I undertook on social media, I'll be doing some work to consolidate all of our content to fewer platforms. So, by audience majority request, episodes of our storytelling show, Stories from the Hearth, move from its own feed to this one. If you subscribed to Stories from the Hearth on the other feed and listened there, thank you. But also, it means there will be a few episodes which come onto your feed as duplicates from the early shows. Now, Apple recently suspended the auto-download option for their podcast app, but if your app brings these down automatically, then just delete the ones you already listened to. Unless you want to listen again, of course. I look forward to bringing more wonderful and varied folklore content to you soon. In the meantime, thanks for listening. See you next time.